Okay.
Good. Good to see you.
Peter.
Hey, everyone. Good evening on this Monday, April 27th. It is a beautiful evening here in Pittsburgh. I know that we're going to be competing with the weather tonight. I mean, it's like 80 degrees and dry. It's like a beautiful first week of, it seems like it's like the first week of June here in Pittsburgh. We don't get a lot of really dry, clear, beautiful days, and this is one of them. My name is Todd, and this is, I'm the executive director of the Veterans Breakfast Club, and this is our VBC Greatest Generation Live World War II Roundtable, and I'm not the host, but I grabbed the mic before Glenn could start talking, and I get to introduce Glenn Flickinger as the host of Greatest Generation Live. How you doing, Glenn?
I'm doing fantastic, and from Hilton Head, no less.
How is it in Hilton Head? Can't be better than Pittsburgh.
It's actually not as warm as Pittsburgh is. So, you know, 75, 77, sunny and sandy.
And I've got to say, I'm very much looking forward to tonight's program. Steve Snyder, who's the author of Shot Down, is going to be presenting about his father's story, essentially World War II story and the air war over Germany. What happened to the crew of his father's plane that got shot down. And I admitted to him when we met just before we started here that I have not read the book. But I'm impressed by the book because I saw the book for sale on Amazon and he has like well over 1,000 reviews. And then he has 30,000 ratings on Goodreads. And I've written books and I don't have 1/10 that number, not 1/20 that number. And so I asked him what his secret was. And well, he said he's a good salesperson. So Steve, thank you. He won't divulge his secrets, but I think he should write an article about how to promote a book because boy, has he done it well. And I know it has to be a good one, that many wonderful reviews on Amazon. So thank you, Steve, for you're joining us from Southern California.
Yes, I am.
Yeah. Seal Beach. How is it at Seal Beach?
Oh, blue sky and sunny, and it's probably in the low to mid 70s.
Okay. Nicer in Pittsburgh.
No humidity, though.
But it's like that year round.
Yes, right. Exactly. I mean, this is the one day a year we'll be able to say that. So that's why I had to get that in. Glenn, I'll just throw it to you.
Okay. Thank you, Todd. As Todd said, I think most of you are on the program know I'm the host of the World War II Roundtable. And as Todd already mentioned, we're really, really pleased to have Steve Snyder on tonight. He wrote the book Shot Down. He'll be showing you this on some PowerPoint slides. And I did read the book. And I have to tell you, Steve, I don't think I said this to you, but when I first ordered it, and I thought, you know, it's not been published. It's written by a non-professional. How good is this going to be? Well, as you can see by all my yellow little tags in there, it's incredibly compelling and very interesting. And Steve is to be congratulated for not only getting this done, but writing a very interesting story of his father, which I'm sure is a heartfelt story from what his father went through. And his father, B-17 pilot, one of many thousands of B-17 pilots shot down. But there's some very interesting twists, which I'll leave to Steve to bring up, about his father and his experience after he was shot down. And in fact, the whole crew is a fascinating story to follow. So without any further ado, I'll ask Steve to take the floor and start his presentation. He's got about a half hour or so PowerPoint. The chat room is open. You can ask questions that way. And certainly once Steve is finished, we'll get into, we hope, a very good back and forth discussion with him. So Steve, the floor is yours.
Okay, well, thank you, Glenn. Let me bring up my presentation here. Here we go. All right. As has been said, the book I wrote is called Shot Down, the true story of pilot Howard Snyder and the crew of the B-17, Susan Ruth. Growing up, I knew the basics of my dad's World War II history. I knew he was a B-17 pilot. He was stationed in England with the 8th Air Force. His plane was named the Susan Ruth after my oldest sister, who was 1 year old at the time that he went overseas. And he flew bombing missions over occupied Europe. And in February 1944, his plane was shot down and he was missing in action for 7 months, but he evaded capture and eventually got back to England. But it wasn't until I retired in 2009 that I really had the time to delve into my dad's war history in more detail. At that time, I had no intention of writing a book. My parents had kept a lot of material and information from the war years, and I just wanted to go through that and organize it and learn more detail. And there were two items that were really significant. One was a diary that my dad wrote while he was missing in action about his plane being shot down. That's absolutely riveting, and it's in the book. And so riveting, that was included in two books that were written. And now I can't get my slides to move here. There we go. The book on the left is called The Mighty Eighth by Gerald Astor. That was about the 8th Air Force, which was stationed in England and flew high altitude daylight precision bombing missions over occupied Europe and Germany. And the goal was to hit military and industrial targets to cripple Nazi Germany's ability to wage war. The moniker The Mighty Eighth was given to the 8th Air Force by noted historian Roger Freeman, because of the number of planes they could put up on missions. They would number into the hundreds. And on December 24th of 1944, 2,000 bombers hit targets around Berlin. I get excited when I see one B-17 up in the sky, and I can't imagine what it must have been like with 2,000. The other book was First Over Germany by Russell Strong. It was about the 306 bomb group that my dad was in. Russell was a navigator in the 306, and after the war became its historian. The motto of the 306 was First Over Germany, because the 306 bomb group was the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, Wilhelmshaven, on January 27th of 1943. The other item that was really significant were all the letters that my dad had written to my mother while he was stationed in England before being shot down. And reading those letters was absolutely fascinating. My dad was very candid in those letters. He talked about what bombing missions were like, talked about what life was like on the air base, what life was like in England and London at the time, escapades of him and his crew. And as I said, I just became fascinated with the story of my dad and his crew, and it became my passion. I started reading book after book about the air war over Europe, went on the internet and spent countless hours doing research, downloading declassified military documents. I went on a quest to find relatives of all his crew members to see what information that they could give to me. Joined a number of World War II organizations, started going to reunions, listening to veterans tell their story. And finally, 3 years into my research, I just came to the conclusion that the story of my dad and his crew was so unique and so compelling that people needed to know about it. So I decided to write a book. From the time I started my research to the time the book was published was 4.5 years. It took me about 12 months to write the manuscript and another 8 months to publish it. I actually formed my own publishing company, Seabreeze Publishing, LLC, which is the name of the street that I live on in Seal Beach, California. And then I contracted with independent professionals for all the associated services like editing, cover design, interior layout, printing the book, et cetera. The first half of the book kind of builds up to the day the plane was shot down. And then the second half is all about what happened afterwards. And the book is just not about my dad, but it goes into detail about what happened to each member of his crew and about all the courageous Belgian people that risked their lives trying to help them. The book's available in all formats, ebook, hardcover, paperback, Audible. So you can enjoy it in various formats. In the print book, though, there's 200 time period photographs, so you can visualize everything that you're reading about. But I probably wouldn't have written the book if it wasn't for two Belgian gentlemen. On the left, you see my dad with Dr. Paul Delahaye. And on the right, you see me with Jacques Lalo. The picture of my dad was taken in 1994 at the 50th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. And the picture of me and Jacques was taken 20 years later at the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Belgium. And these two men were young boys during the war, and they were greatly affected by it. They saw firsthand the atrocities committed by the Nazis against their family and friends. And later in life, they became local historians, and they interviewed all these members of the Belgium underground about events that took place involving my dad and his crew, and they documented their testimony. And they gave me unbelievably detailed information about events that would have been lost forever without their dedicated research. So I owe them a great deal. Dr. Delahaye passed away in 2013, but Jacques is still with us, and he's a dear friend of mine. Initially, my dad didn't go into the Air Force as a result of the first peacetime draft in U.S. history implemented by President Franklin Roosevelt in the fall of 1940. My dad went into the Army in April of 1941, and he was stationed at Fort Lewis, Washington. And at the time, the U.S. military was woefully weak. They ranked 18th in the world in military strength behind Romania. And they were also very ill-equipped, as you can tell by the World War I vintage uniform that my dad has on in this picture. 3 months later in July, he married Ruth Hempel at First Lutheran Church in Pasadena, California. My mother was born and raised in Pasadena, as was I. It was right after she graduated from UCLA, where she was a classmate of the legendary Jackie Robinson. My dad was born in spent his early years in Norfolk, Nebraska, and he and his family moved to California right before high school. A few months later, on December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy, Japan bombed Pearl Harbor, and the United States was at war. My mother was very worried, the future was very uncertain, so she went up to Washington over Christmas to visit my dad. And 9 months later, Susan Ruth was born. Well, my dad at the time, you know, he has a new bride, a baby on the way, and he was worried about how he's going to support his new family. He didn't think he'd do that very well on a private's pay in the Army. So he decided to volunteer for the Air Force where he could make more money, especially if he made it through pilot training and became an officer. So in June of 1942, he went through pre-flight training at Santa Ana Army Air Base in Southern California. And then he went through the various stages of pilot training. This slide's a little busy, but on the left-hand side, there are the three main components of pilot training. First was primary training. And then if the pilots or the cadets, I should say, that made it through primary, they went on to basic. And pilot training was really rough, both mentally and physically. Had to be really sharp. 40% of the cadets flunked out and never washed out and didn't make it through pilot training. After basic, they separated the pilots out going to advanced training. They either went into single engine planes or fighters, or they went into twin engine planes, which resulted in either transports or bombers. Typically the shorter pilots went into fighters because of the cramped conditions in the cockpit. My dad was 6'3", so they put him into twin engine planes. But I also think it was based on personality. It seems to me those fighter pilots tended to be pretty cocky, have big egos, be risk takers, more independent, whereas those bomber pilots tended to be a little more level-headed and team players. Here you see my dad in primary training at Santa Ana, California. This was a big day for him. It was right after he soloed for the first time. And you can always tell when a cadet soloed because you can't wear your goggles on top of your helmet until you've soloed. So that was a big day for him. You see him smoking there. Everybody, I think, smoked back in those days. These are the three different planes he flew in pilot training. In primary, up at top, he flew a Stearman biplane. And then in basic, a single wing Vultee Valiant. And then in advanced training, twin engine Curtiss-Wright AT-9, also flew a Cessna Bobcat. He graduated from advanced pilot training in April of 1943, where he received his pilot's wings and commissioned as a second lieutenant. And then he went on to transitional training, where he learned how to fly a four-engine B-17 bomber. And then from there, he went to operational crew training, where the various members of the crew came together and they learned to operate as a team. And then once deemed ready, they were assigned overseas to the European Theater of Operations. My dad and his crew reported to the 306 Bomb Group on October 21st of 1943. It was located in Thurlow, England, which is about 60 miles north of London. This is what the base looked like at the time. It's no longer there, but they have a nice little museum that my wife and I have been to on a couple of occasions. Here you see the insignia of the 306 Bomb Group. It was the Triangle H. There were three air divisions in the 8th Air Force. The 306 was in the 1st Air Division, signified by a triangle. And then each bomb group had a designated letter for the 306, so it was an H. So he had the Triangle H representing the 306. In addition to being the first bomb group to hit a target in Germany, the 306 was also the longest serving bomb group in the 8th Air Force. They reported there in September of 1942, and they didn't go back home until December of 1946. They stayed on after the war, involved in the Casey Jones project, which was the aerial photo mapping of Western Europe and Northern Africa. Most of you have probably seen the movie 12 O'Clock High, starring Gregory Peck. Well, that was based on a true story about the 306 bomb group. The fictional bomb group in the movie, the 918th, was derived by multiplying the 306 by three. A further distinction the 306 bomb group had was that their flight surgeon, Thurman Schuller, was responsible for convincing 8th Bomber Command General Ira Aker to implement a mission limit. Up until the spring of 1943, there was no limit on the number of missions these combat crews flew. And the morale was getting very, very low because they realized they'd never make it back home. They'd either be killed or they'd be shot down and become prisoners of war. Schuller recommended a mission limit of 20, but Aker set it at 25. But at least the bomber crews had a light at the end of the tunnel and something they could shoot for. Later on, when Jimmy Doolittle took over the 8th Air Force, in January of 1944, he eventually raised the mission limits to 30 and then to 35. The 306 Bomb Group flew B-17s. The 1st and 3rd Air Divisions and the 8th Air Force flew B-17s. The 2nd Air Division flew B-24 Liberators. Now, this is nicknamed the Flying Fortress because the firepower it had on the plane, it had up to 13 50 caliber machine guns that could put out a lot of firepower and can also take a tremendous amount of battle damage and continue flying. Each bomber had tail markings to identify them. Here again, you see the Triangle H of the 1st Air Division and the 306 Bomb Group. And then each plane had a specific identification number on the tail, which was assigned by the manufacturer. The Boeing company designed the B-17 and manufactured 64%, but the Douglas Aircraft Company and Lockheed Vega each produced 18% of the bombers as well. There were three different types of B-17s flown in Europe. First was the E model, but they only made about 500 of those, so that was quickly phased out by the F model. And that was eventually phased out in the fall of 1943 by the definitive B-17 model, the G model. And you can always tell the G model by the chin turret under the nose here. Here's my dad's crew. A B-17 had a 10-man crew. They had four officers who were kneeling in front. In the lower left is my dad. He was the first pilot, and as such, the commander of the plane and the crew. And then going across, you had the co-pilot, the navigator and the bombardier, and then behind them were the were six enlisted men or non-commissioned officers who were mainly gunners. Five of these men came back home, but five of them did not. That's not the Susan Ruth that you see that they're standing in front of. That's just another B-17 that they took their crew picture when they arrived in England. And I'd also like to point out the nose art on the upper left there. I love the nose art. It's interesting that the Air Force was the only entity that allowed their planes to be painted. The Navy didn't, the Marines didn't, nor did other countries. But the Air Force thought it would help the morale of these young guys if they could personalize their planes and name and paint them. And they were very creative in what they named and painted their planes. Many times it was a cartoon character, but more often than not, it was a scantily clad or nude woman, because after all, these guys were in their late teens and early 20s and were virile young men. My dad flew his first combat mission on November 3rd of 1944 to Wilhelmshaven. It was the first time that the 8th Air Force put up over 500 bombers on a mission. And flying combat was brutal and very dangerous. 26,000 men in the 8th Air Force died during World War II, which was more than the entire Marine Corps fighting in the Pacific. Another 28,000 men became prisoners of war after their planes were knocked out of the sky by either German fighters or at an aircraft fire. Being a combat crewman in the 8th Air Force was the most dangerous duty assignment in the United States military during World War II. It was on a mission to Frankfurt, Germany on February 8th of 1944, where my dad's plane, the Susan Ruth, dropped their bombs successfully, but their bomb bay doors got hit by anti-aircraft fire, or called flak. And they couldn't get the bomb bay doors back up. And as a result, that caused a drag on the plane and they started to lose airspeed. And they were lagging behind the bomber formation, which was heading back to England to their bases. And they were singled out by two German Focke-Wulf German fighters, which you see here. And like wolves or lions, they swooped in on their prey. And in the ensuing air battle, the Susan Ruth was shot down. Two crew members were killed in the plane, and the other eight were able to bail out successfully. But both those German planes were shot down. One was piloted by Siegfried Merrick, and his plane crashed and he died in the plane. And the other, Focke-Wulf, was piloted by Hans Berger, who was able to bail out and made it through the war. During my research, one day my wife asked me, or told me, I should say, well, why don't you try to find the German pilot that shot down your dad's plane? And I was thinking to myself, well, she is naive. She has no idea what she's talking about. It'll be impossible. But like a good husband, I did what she told me to do. And lo and behold, I found Hans Berger. And fortunately for me, he became a translator after the war. So he speaks perfect English. And he gave me some wonderful insight that's in the book about what it was like to go up against the 8th Air Force. After my dad bailed out, he came down in some trees right at the French-Belgian border. This is one of the 200 pictures that are in the book and was sent to him by two of the young men who helped him down out of the trees. His parachute got hung up on the branches in the trees here and he was dangling 20 feet off the ground and couldn't get down. But two Belgian men, Henri Franken and Raymond Durvan, came to his rescue before the Germans could get to him. They went back to the farmhouse, got a ladder and a rope, and they helped him down this tree. That's Henri Franken standing next to the tree. They helped my dad down. Henri sent that picture to my dad after the war. This occurred during the early afternoon. So after they helped him down, they told him to stay put and hide, because they thought it was too dangerous to try to move him during daylight with German patrols looking for him. So that night they came back and got him and they took him to the Durvan farmhouse, which is still there today. It's right at the French-Belgian border. That house is in Belgium, but those trees are in France. He stayed there one night. They thought it was too dangerous for him to stay there any longer than that, again, with those German patrols in the area. So on the following night, a Belgian customs officer, Paul Tilcan, came on a tandem bicycle to take him to a safer location. They started out that it was the middle of the night, pitch dark, kind of rainy. My dad had some shrapnel wounds in his leg and can only pedal with his good leg. And they came to a hill. They had to get off the bike and started pushing the bike up the hill. When they got to the top of the hill, there was a building there, a little cabaret cafe. This is what it looked like in 1994. The lights were on, music was playing, people were laughing, talking loudly. And all of a sudden, two German officers come walking out the door with their arms around these two young girls. And one of them comes up to my dad, puts his arm around my dad and asks for a light for a cigarette. Well, my dad's petrified. He can't speak German or French at that time. But fortunately, Paul Tilken was able to and lit the guy's cigarette and they let him go on their way. My dad said that these two Germans were too drunk, or as he said, snockered, and too interested in these young girls to pay too much attention to a couple of yokels pushing this bike up the hill in the middle of the night. And after that, my dad was moved from place to place to place. How long he stayed at any location depended on how brave the people were who lived there and how dangerous the Belgium underground thought it was for him to stay there. He might spend one night, he might spend 6 weeks. Here you see a few of the people that helped him. He had many people help him. My dad's on the left with the beret. They gave him that to try to help him, fit into the local population. Although, as you can also tell, he's quite a bit taller than the locals. And the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew, or any downed airman for that matter, were unbelievably brave. They risked not only their lives, but the lives of their family and friends hiding downed airmen. If the Gestapo, the secret German police, found out about it, they'd be arrested, tortured, and either shot or sent to a concentration camp. And some of the people who helped my dad and other members of his crew did meet that fate. Here you see a couple of women who my dad stayed with for lengthy periods of time. On the left is Ghislaine Bayou. It was with her and her husband Maurice that my dad wrote his diary. And then on his right is Jeanette Gadin. Her husband was actually a captain in the French army who was captured when Germany first invaded the lowlands in France in 1940, and he became a prisoner of war for the remainder of the war. Normally, when the underground came across downed airmen, they tried to get them back to England through various escape routes, down through France, over the Pyrenees, into Spain, and then out through British-controlled Gibraltar. But something always went wrong trying to get my dad out, and it became very stressful for him. After all, his plane was attacked, he was on fire, he had to bail out, he came down in a foreign country, had no idea where he was, didn't know what happened to his buddies on the crew, couldn't communicate with the U.S. military. He was being helped by complete strangers. They really couldn't communicate. My dad had a little French-English dictionary he could refer to, and any of these people helping him could be a collaborator and turn him over to the Gestapo. And there were several occasions where he was almost discovered that are described in the book. One of those was at the home of Maurice and Ghislaine Bayou. One evening, there were loud pounding at the door, and Maurice told my dad to go up on the roof and hide. And then when the Germans were gone, he'd come back and get him. And you really can't tell from this angle of the picture, but in the roof out of the attic, there's just a real small little tiny window you have to crawl out of to get up on the roof. And it's a tile roof at a very steep angle. I've been in that house at really all these places that I'm showing you. And that would have been pretty scary. And my dad spent the entire night up there. Maurice never came and got him because the Germans didn't leave the area and kept combing the area. And as I mentioned, there are several instances where he was almost discovered on other occasions. Finally, my dad got tired of hiding. Word came that the Allies had landed at Normandy on D-Day, June 6th. And he decided to get back into the fight. Unlike most airmen, he had that year's training in the infantry, so he knew how to fight on the ground. He wanted to join the French resistance. His helpers tried to talk him out of it because it was so dangerous. He could either die fighting against the Germans, or if they captured him, he would have been shot on the spot as a terrorist. but he thought it was his duty to get back in the conflict. And another one of his helpers, Amy Cools, they went on bicycles and traveled across the border from Belgium into France. And he hooked up with a unit of the French resistance. This is not the unit he hooked up with, but it gives you an idea of what they look like. They were called the Mackie, and they were independent ragtag guerrilla groups located all across France. There were about 20 in the group my dad joined, led by a French lieutenant who had escaped from a German prisoner of war camp. And their job was to harass the Germans. They would disrupt communications, sabotage railroad lines, attack convoys, assassinate German officers. And they got their instructions over the BBC. And my dad said they were amazingly accurate. If they said a convoy was coming down this road on this day at this time, sure enough, they'd be there. And that was as a result of the British cracking the German Enigma code and knowing everything the Germans were up to. And they were also supplied by the British through airdrops. Here you see the farmhouse that the Mackie group stayed in right across the border in France and Wallers. That's a view from Belgium. This picture was taken in 1994. That's my dad standing in front of the front of the building. He stayed in this tower. You can see the two windows up on top here. And on one occasion, it was early in the morning. He was just in his skivvies. It was shaving cream in his face, and he saw a German patrol coming up the road. And so he had to hightail it out. He jumped out of these windows here in the back of the farm building and hightailed it into the forest so he wouldn't get caught. And again, there's a number of encounters that the Mackie group had with the Germans that are described in the book. Who took this picture and how it ever got back to my dad is I'll never know, but this is my dad fighting with the French resistance in 1944. Finally, 7 months after he bailed out, word came that there were U.S. troops in the nearby village of Treslong, France. So he walked into the town square, went up to an army major. Actually, it was an element of Patton's Third Army, which would come up through France after D-Day. Identified himself. They interrogated him to make sure he was who he said he was. And then he caught a convoy taking German prisoners to Paris and then hopped a ride on a DC-3 to go back to England, where he sent sent a Western Union telegram to my mother saying he was fit as a fiddle and to bank the money, honey. He had all that back pay coming from his months of being missing in action. Belgium's a unique little country. A lot of people don't realize it's really divided in two. The upper half of Belgium is called Flanders, where they speak Dutch and it's rather industrial. And then the lower half of Belgium is called Wallonia, where they speak French. And that's where my dad and other members of his crew was right at the French-Belgian border here, where the plane and the guys who bailed out, actually my dad and the plane came down in Belgium. And the other members of the crew were able to bail out, came down in France, but then the resistance brought them back over into Belgium. My dad stayed in Charleroi for quite a while. And then the French resistance stayed in that farmhouse down here in France, and Treslong, France is right down here. The Belgian people are wonderful people. To this day, they're still so thankful and so grateful for the Americans coming to their rescue and liberating them from 4 years of Nazi oppression and Nazi occupation. And they do a great job of educating the younger generations to remember the importance as well. They've erected a number of memorials in the area and have ceremonies on the anniversary dates of those events. But the big celebrations are annually every year around September 2nd, which is the Liberation of Belgium Day. Here you see a poster from the 70th anniversary in 2014. And these celebrations last several days. They erect these big tents. This shows you just a portion of a tent. can seat hundreds of people. They have band concerts and dances and luncheons and dinners, and they're wonderful affairs. They have military encampments and U.S. military vehicle parades. The locals dress up in, you know, period costumes, and the local beer Chimay just flows and everyone really has a grand time. But they have more serious moments when they have ceremonies at various memorials. This is the memorial at Cendron, which is right at the French-Belgian border with the U.S. 9th Infantry first crossed over the Wartroise River from France into Belgium to liberate the country. All the villagers come out, the U.S. military is represented, the Belgian military, the French military, all the dignitaries make speeches. Again, you can see all these the young people right up in front, again, to emphasize the importance of these events. This is the memorial to my dad and his crew, the Susan Ruth Memorial, which was erected in Mackenwas, Belgium, just a couple hundred yards from where the plane came down. Now, on the front, it has a couple of plaques that has the names of the crew, their ages at the time the plane went down, and their crew positions. Like most World War II veterans, my dad didn't talk a lot about the war until this memorial was erected in 1989. He and three other members of the crew that were still living at the time went over for the dedication ceremonies. And there my dad was reunited with all these Belgian people that hit him during the war, saw these places that where he was hidden, and that brought it all back, and he started talking about it. 5 years later in 1994 was my first trip to Belgium when I accompanied my parents to the 50th anniversary. And that's when it became personal for me because I went around, you know, my dad showing me all these places, you know, so I could see things firsthand. I've been to Belgium six times and it's just an amazing experience. Here you see the dedication ceremonies in 1989. Paul Delahaye, who I mentioned earlier with the beard here, he was the president of the American Belgium Foundation that organized all these events. This is my dad with the tie making a speech. And then these are three of his helpers. This is Jeanette Gaudin, who was in that earlier picture that I showed to you that her husband was a captain in the French army. This is Nellie Tilquin. She was the wife of the Belgium's customs officer who came and got my dad on that tandem bicycle. A couple months later, after he helped my dad, he was arrested by the Germans, tortured, sent to prison. And he narrowly evaded or escaped being executed, but he died at a young age from the beatings that he took while he was being tortured. And then this gentleman here in the trench coat, that's the other man who helped my dad down from the tree, Raymond Durvin. Two of the occasions that I've been to Belgium in 2016 and 2019, I continued on to Munich, Germany, to visit that German Luftwaffe pilot, Hans Berger, who shot down my dad's plane. Hans lives in Munich, Germany, and interestingly enough, he's the only person in the shot down story who's still living. He's 97 years old. Here's a picture of me and Hans. He's wearing his fighter jacket. I don't know if you can see this too well, but he has his Iron Cross on there. He shot down seven B-17s and one Spitfire, and he himself was shot down on three different occasions. We were in his apartment there, and then we went to lunch at the Hofbrauhaus and enjoyed a nice German beer. And Hans and I have become dear friends. I'm often asked, well, how can you like this guy or be friendly with this guy who shot down your dad's plane? But I came to find out after talking with Hans that the gunners on my dad's plane actually shot Hans down at the same time. They shot each other down. And Hans was really just like the U.S. airman. He was a young guy, 19, 20 years old, you know, fighting for his country, trying to do a job and trying to stay alive. He said it was unfortunate they had to be shooting at each other, but that was war. And World War II was the defining moment of my dad's life, probably for any guy that served in World War II. I mean, nothing could equal that. And at one point in time, my dad's life and Hans' life crossed paths. So Hans is part of my dad's story, part of my dad's life. So I have always felt a, you know, a kinship and a relationship to him. Here you see my dad and I in 2004 at the World War II Memorial in Washington, D.C. I accompanied him on a reunion to the Air Force's Escape and Evasion Society, and we took a bus down from Pennsylvania. Actually, it was we were at King of Prussia. It was right before the official dedication that year. He wanted to see the memorial before he died. And that was the last trip he ever took. My dad wasn't the last crew member to die, but he was the oldest at 91. And today, you know, all the World War II veterans are in their mid to late 90s or even early hundreds. At the end of World War II, there were 16 million World War II veterans. And as you can see from this graph, we're losing them at a rapid pace. Only about 2% of those men, those great men, are still with us. There is no other event in history that affected more people than World War II. 60 million people died, millions more were wounded, millions more were left homeless and displaced. It changed the course of America and the world forever. And the brave young men who fought and died for freedom are without doubt the greatest generation, and their sacrifice must never be forgotten. It's our duty to remember. Thank you.
Thank you, Steve, for a very interesting story. It's what your father did, what those crew members did, is something to be remembered for all time. And certainly for us, it's our duty to keep telling the story to the younger generations that are coming up. Let me ask you, some questions, Steve. When you and I talked in reading your book, you also go into pretty exhaustive detail on the other crew members. So, don't have to do it by name, but of the 10 crew members, we know two died in the crash itself, in the shoot down itself. What happened to the other 8 crew members, Steve?
Okay, well,
one is your father, of course. So the others.
Right. Well, 3 of them were picked up immediately by the Germans and became prisoners of war. 2 of them were very severely injured, and they were eventually repatriated back to the U.S. before the war ended because of the seriousness of their wounds. And then the 3rd crew member that became a POW, he spent the entire war as a POW, and then was liberated when the war ended. And he was involved, some people might be familiar with the Black March, the 86-day, 500-mile march of prisoners across Germany when the Russians were coming in, which was an amazing story in itself. One other crew member evaded capture. Unlike my dad, though, who was moved from place to place to place, he was hidden in one house the entire time by a woman and her 2 daughters. He was 19, then turned 20, and then celebrated his 20th birthday with them. And then the other 3 crew members, they evaded capture for a couple months, and they joined up with 5 other downed U.S. airmen. And the 8 of them were hiding in this makeshift hut that they and some other Belgium members of the Belgium Underground built. But a Belgium collaborator ratted them out to the Germans, and they came and surrounded the hut, captured them, interrogated them, and shot, or I should say murdered, all 8 of them. So finally the crew came home and 5 did not. So there's a lot of, you know, agony and tragedy that happened. And then also, you know, a lot of joy as well. Another thing that makes the book personal, that there's a lot of letters, or I should say excerpts, some letters in the book from members of the crew and relatives of the crew. The ones after the crew went down and were missing in action, the exchanges that the wives and mothers and sweethearts had, and the worry and the grief they had with their loved ones missing in action, are really, really moving.
Right. you spend a lot of time on those letters and, you know, what's happening into the families in the States while all these men are going through this in Europe. And that part is heart-rending, you know, because so little information provided that, you know, could be provided, right? Talk a little bit about the Belgium and French resistance fighters who helped all these men. And there's something I've not read a lot about, Steve, the Shelbourne escape line. And was one of the sort of underground escape routes that existed, right? And many of these resistance fighters who helped our men were, as the one example, the man was tortured and survived, but many were tortured and executed. So speak just a little bit about how all that happened.
Sure. Well, in addition to those eight U.S. airmen that were captured in the woods near Chimay, Belgium, were two young Belgian men in their early 20s, members of the Belgium underground who were helping them. They would bring them food and clothing and things like that. They were sent to concentration camps in Germany, never to be heard from again. But as you mentioned, the escape routes, Shelbourg was one of the escape routes there in France. And actually there was a member of my dad's crew in training actually my dad kicked off his crew, but became a member of another crew, and his plane was shot down, and he was helped by the underground and made it out through the Shelbourg line. The Shelbourg line took men to the coast, and then the British would send these kind of like PT boats to pick them up on shore, you know, all at night. I mean, I can't imagine how scary that must have been. Right. The biggest escape route was called the Comet Line, and that's the one that, you know, went through France over the Pyrenees and then down through Spain and out through British controlled Gibraltar. And the Germans would plant spies along these lines, and they would then, you know, capture members of the line. That's one of the reasons that something went wrong trying to get my dad out, because these lines were compromised frequently by Germans posing as members of the underground and then capturing the members of the underground, either executing them or sending them to concentration camps. So many of the people on these lines were captured and killed. The bravery of these people are just unbelievable. But they felt that here these total strangers from another country were coming to liberate them from the Nazis. So it was the least they could do to risk their lives to try to help them.
Right, right. Todd, can see anybody with questions or hands up? Are there members of our audience that want to ask a question or two?
No, but I will invite people to ask a question if they'd like. I do have one strange little question, and that is, why in the world would they have taken pictures of your father? Some of those photographs are just stunning, but you wonder, why would they take those photos that could be used as evidence?
Well, my dad asked Maurice that, and he said he had lots of other papers that it could doom him. So a few more weren't going to make any difference. Oh, one of the I will say a little bit more about the Tilkans. It was early in the morning. They were asleep in bed. They had two young children. The Nazis, you know, just barged into their house, completely ransacked the house, just tore everything apart. And Paul had a pistol that he had hidden, and it was illegal to have any firearm. And so that got him, and that's one of the reasons he was arrested. He was also arrested with Henri Franken, two of the men that helped my dad down from the tree. And Nellie and her two young children, she had to go live with their parents because they just destroyed their home. And that happened frequently, you know, to people who weren't even in the underground. You know, they just come in, and then you had the collaborators. I could talk about this a lot. And who would hold grudges against their neighbor, and they'd tell the Gestapo that their neighbor was a member of the underground, even though they weren't, just to get them in trouble. There was lots of backstabbing, and it was just a terrible time. I mean, we in the U.S., we've never been occupied. We just have no idea what that was like, and they lost all their freedoms.
Right. You think about those collaborators, you know, is a fascinating thought, I guess. And I think I also know what happened to them after the war, once the Allies liberated Belgium and France, right? Those people were brought out into the open, and some of them dealt with harshly.
Oh yeah, when the war ended, Europe was in total chaos. Yeah. And there were vigilantes that, like you say, you know, they killed and shot or hanged some of these collaborators. All the women who collaborated, they shaved their heads as a mark of being a collaborator. Yeah.
I see that we have Trey here has his hand up, and I want to remind people Trey joined us last week as Ian. And during our discussion of 30 Seconds Over Tokyo, he amazed us with his knowledge of World War II. Trey, do you have your hand up, or was you?
No, I have my hand up.
Okay, yeah, great. Thanks for joining us, Trey.
Just to address the Ian thing, my official name's Ian, but I go by Trey since I'm the third. I have a question. The other main U.S. bomber, that main U.S. heavy bomber that was used in the war was the B-24 Liberator. It was known as a death trap in the early war, but it eventually rose to power to become one of the greatest airplanes of all time and being one of the most produced planes of World War II, right behind the IL-2 Sturmbunk, which was a Russian ground attack aircraft. I was wondering if Mr. Snyder's father ever saw or flew one of those, because those are very interesting planes. They have a very interesting silhouette with their forward turret. They actually had, instead of a chin turret, they had a nose turret instead of a nose-like dome like you see on something like a B-25.
I'm very impressed with your knowledge. That's fantastic.
Thank you.
I love it when younger generations take an interest in world history, and particularly World War II. Yeah, I go to 8th Air Force Historical Society reunions, and you know, these guys who flew B-17s and the guys who flew B-24s always get into these arguments about which is the better bombers. Interesting to sit there and listen to these vets talk. The B-17 bombers say, well, the B-24 was the box that the B-17 came in. And then the B-24 guys will say, well, actually, a B-17 didn't have a 10-man crew. They had an 11-man crew. They had 10 combat crewmen and a publicist. And you're right. There were over 18,000 B-24s made compared to over 12,000 B-17s. And the B-24 could fly faster and carry a bigger bomb load, but the B-17s could fly higher and take a tremendous amount, greater amount of battle damage. The B-17 was also easier to fly than the B-24. But my dad never flew a B-24 beside the smaller aircraft he flew in pilot training. He only flew the B-17. And I will mention that when my dad got back to England, the Air Force had a rule that if you were shot down and helped by the underground, that you couldn't go back into combat, because they were worried if you were shot down a second time, captured by the Germans and tortured, that you give up the identity of the people that helped you the first time. The only exception to that rule is Chuck Yeager, who personally met with General Eisenhower and talked him into letting him go back into combat. So yeah. My dad was sent back to the US, and then he became a B-17 flight instructor in Florida and in Ohio for the remainder of the war.
I just wanted to add something. Just a small thing. One of the reasons that you mentioned the publicity that the B-17 got compared to the B-24, I just wanted to add, maybe I think they looked more elegant in the public's eye to see just this fleet of big old bomber planes flying over. The B-17 kind of looked like an ugly duckling.
Yeah.
Or if like you've been on the Doolittle raid stream, a ruptured duck.
Yeah. Like a guppy, a pregnant guppy.
Yeah. Well, just to throw, it was an ugly plane.
Just to throw in the British side of this, because I actually had the chance at a World War II conference to talk to a British Lancaster pilot. And they claimed their plane was better, carried more bomb load, which I think it did, and could go further.
The Lancaster was able to carry so much bomb load that it would be able to fly to Berlin, drop a bunch of bombs, and just come back. It actually sunk the KMS Tirpitz, which I have the sister ship up here, actually, Bismarck. That's a whole nother story. Using a very creative type of bomb called the Tallboy. It was one of the largest ordnances, non-nuclear ordnances as ever used. I think it was the largest. And what they did is they just dropped them en masse on top of the Tirpitz, and they were specifically designed to fit the Lancaster and to sink the Tirpitz. It's a very interesting plane, the Lancaster. I just wanted to put that out there.
Yeah,
wonderful. Very impressive.
The British bomber pilots felt underappreciated, not only from us, but also from their fellow Brits themselves, because of the sort of the story behind, you know, what they did.
I heard a joke from one British Lancaster pilot. I was listening to like one of his talks. He said the reason that you always see the movies about the B-17s is that you can't really shoot at night. If you're familiar with what the Lancaster did, they were night bombers. They were too inadequately armed, unlike a B-17, which had a ton of machine guns, like every American bomber, and frankly, American tank, boat, whatever. In the war, they just Americans slapped machine guns everywhere. The Lancasters had relatively few, but they used they're very stealthy. Well, they weren't stealthy; they were huge. If you've seen one, but they were able to be painted fairly a lot darker than something like a B-17, and the British were more skilled in night interceptor and night bomber missions, and they were able to use great success to that Lancasters in that role, especially as close support weapons, because they just didn't have the range of the B-17 and the B-24.
Thank you, Trey.
Hey, Steve, I have a question for Steve. Steve, you grew up with your dad was your dad, but at some point in your research, your dad must have, your vision of him must have just changed and enlarged. I mean, he's no longer just your dad. He's a hero.
Yeah, I definitely, in writing the book and doing the research, I definitely got an even greater appreciation for my dad. Well, you know, I don't know how many people would have made the decision he made to go fight with the French resistance. The smart thing to do, the safest thing to do, was just for him to stay put, hunker down, and wait for the U.S., you know, forces to come up to liberate the area. You know, risky's in his life to go fight with the French resistance. I doubt if I would have done that, and I doubt if very many people would have done that. It took a tremendous amount of courage and bravery.
What about his makeup? I mean, let's say that you didn't know that fact, that he made that choice to fight. Would you have judged your dad as being the kind of person who would make that choice or not, just based on what you knew about him growing up, having him be your father? Did he seem different, special, you know, brave?
Yeah, my dad, as I mentioned, was 6'3". He was a big guy, a rugged guy, a no-nonsense guy. My sisters and I always compared him to John Wayne. Or for those in the audience I know are old enough to remember Gunsmoke, you know, James Arness. He was, you know, that type of guy.
Ida May's old enough.
You know, he had a strong character, high morals. He and my mother were, you know, deeply religious, a wonderful Christian couple. And he had, you know, he believed strongly in his beliefs, and he was willing to back them up. Yeah, he was a wonderful man, but a loving father, you know, very supportive, coached my little league teams, you know, and did all that as well.
Steve, were you able to meet any of the other crewmen while they were still alive?
Only when I was too young to know the importance of it. My parents did get together with them and their their wives, and they'd tell me to come in and say hello to, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Daniels. And, you know, I was playing toys in my room, and I'd come in and go, hi, you know, nice to meet you. And then go back to my toys. The one thing that was really neat though, is that Joe Musial, one of the waste gunners, when they went back for the dedication of the Susan Ruth Memorial, he filmed like several days. And even though it's in this really grainy, you know, that old camcorder film and the quality's low, he filmed hours and hours, which it's great to see him interact and talk about their World War II experiences. And so I got a feel for what they were like.
And what's interesting, Joe Musial was, I'll let you give the line.
Cousin of Stan Musial.
Stan Musial. Yeah. Cousin or nephew?
Nephew.
Yeah. And he lost his leg. He was one of those ones that was badly injured, right?
Yeah, his foot.
His foot?
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, I guess last chance for any other questions of Steve Snyder tonight.
Yeah. Jim Roberts has his hand up. I think Matthew, did you? Yeah, Matthew. Let's go with Matthew.
Hi. Thank you. Mr. Snyder, pleasure to hear the story of your father, and just amazing. But you had mentioned that you met the pilot, the German pilot, Hans, who had shot the plane down. And you said that he gave you some perspective on what the Germans thought of the American bombers coming over. Can you share some of that?
He was absolutely scared to death. You know, besides the bombers, you know, having all those machine guns, he had to deal with all the fighter escorts. And they would be so outnumbered that, you know, it was like most of all his friends died in the war. You know, they were all killed because they were outnumbered 10-1 when they'd go up. He said it was very, very daunting. As I mentioned, he was shot down 3 times. And probably one of the reasons why he might not have been killed is at the end of the war, he became a test pilot for the Henkel 162, the single-engined jet fighter.
Oh, yeah.
The Germans were trying to produce. It never really got into combat. They couldn't work the bugs out of it. But that probably might have saved his life doing that.
Okay. Thank you very much.
And I asked him if he feared the B-17 or the B-24 more, and he said they were both just as frightening.
I would add, what's a miracle for that man? I think you said he was 19 in 1945 when he shot down your father's plane. Is that right, Steve?
He was 22, I think, at that time.
Okay, but still.
No, he was 20.
Because, you know, the German fighter pilots were decimated starting in 1943, 1944, going forward. And they kept bringing in younger and younger kids and giving them, you know, a minimal amount of training, you know, learn how to fly, and then, you know, and they were running out of fuel. They couldn't train these kids. And so the 19 and 20 year olds that went up, 90% of them were shot down in their first 2 or 3 missions.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because we had,
Glenn, go ahead.
All right, go ahead, Matthew. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
Excuse me. You had mentioned that the British pilots thought they were underappreciated, and it immediately made me think of, you know, the Brits would say to the American soldiers, you're overpaid, you're oversexed, and you're over here. And of which our American soldiers would say, well, you're underpaid, undersexed, and under Eisenhower.
Right.
So underappreciated, I guess, goes right with that.
Yeah. In the book, I talk somewhat about what it was like in England and London at the time, the relationship of, you know, the flyers with the local women and the interaction and that stuff that is rather interesting. There were a couple guys on my dad's crew that we'll just call them ladies' men.
Jim Roberts.
Yeah, just two things. One, this is actually a clock out of a B-17.
Hold it. Let's spotlight you, Jim, so other people could see that. I'm going to spotlight for everybody. That's a clock out of a B-17.
Yep. If you look at the engineer's flight console, you'll be at the top row in the center.
Boy.
My dad pulled it out of a wreck. He was a crew chief on a B-17 in World War II.
Jeez.
Fabulous.
It actually works. There's no jewels in it. And I wore it out as a kid. I wore it all the time. So I turned it over to a watchmaker and they played with it for 2 years. It'll run for 10 seconds or 30 seconds and then quit. it was designed for the life of a B-17, which was, you know, the one question I have for you is, did your father's crew fly their plane from the States to England when they went? Because we know about the WASP pilots who delivered the planes to the appropriate places in North America. But did your father's crew fly it over?
Yes. And that's in the book, actually. My dad said it was pretty scary because, you know, they flew over at night and you couldn't see anything. They flew their own plane. They picked up a new plane at Scott Field in Illinois, and then flew to Maine, and then at the Gander, Newfoundland, and then went over. And they had a brand new plane. As soon as they got to England, they took it away from them. You know, I guess gave it to a more experienced crew, and they got a beat up B-17. Yeah, not all the crews flew their planes over, but some of them did.
And there were a few that were lost in that trip over, because that was a dangerous route. Weather was terrible. More or less did reckoning, not much in the way of navigation tools, right?
Right.
So.
Absolutely.
Steve, you are such a pro at presenting this story. You probably have done this before.
A couple times.
How many talks do you think you've given about your dad's story?
Ooh. But over 50.
Okay.
I've never really. Yeah, maybe 75. I don't know. I have different length presentations. I have a 20 minute. This was a 30 minute. I also have a 45 minute.
You know how to hit your marks, as they say in showbiz. I mean, you absolutely hit your marks. Just, it was a pleasure and a wonder listening to this amazing story. And we did put the link to your website here on the Zoom side and on the Facebook Live side. So if people want to order the book, they can do it through your website. And they could also watch a wonderful 13-minute documentary that you made about this story. And there's another thing, a gallery. We tried to get this across in our emails to earlier this week. I don't know how many people actually clicked, but you did something amazing on your website. And that is you created this wonderful video gallery of archival film footage from World War II, specifically about the air war and airplanes and aircraft. I mean, you have dozens and dozens, if not hundreds of videos there. Thank you for doing that.
Yeah, there's a lot of my websites. I just didn't want it to be, you know, about the book.
Right.
But I wanted to, there's a lot of interviews with veterans, World War II veterans on there, and links to archival footage, like you say, a lot of links to research sites about the air war over Europe and resistance, you know, the escape routes. There's a lot of information on there for people to research and learn about the air war.
And that's stevesnyderauthor.com. And I put the link specifically to the World War II entertainment, the film, the archival film that you have. There's so much footage there and it's so fascinating. I mean, you could lose days just clicking through and watching the snafu cartoons and the training films and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, all the TV show 12 O'Clock High, all those episodes are on there. And yeah, like you say, Private Snafu. I love Private Snafu.
Fantastic.
Yeah, people can get an autographed copy of the book off my website. Most people get it on Amazon, but if you want an autographed copy, you can get it on my website.
Excellent.
And I would just chime in and say again, as I said at the beginning, I highly recommend you read the book. It's well written. It's an easy read, if you will. It's compelling, and recommended highly for those of you who love to read World War II history. It's very well done.
Thanks, Glenn. I appreciate that.
Okay. So, Steve, Todd, are we going to move on to a second subject here? Or
yeah, I was wondering if nobody has any other questions for Steve or comments that they want to make about the air war, specifically B-17s. I thought that we could start a conversation about Rick Atkinson's 10 Things You Need to Know About the U.S. Army in World War II, which is a wonderful kind of launch pad for a discussion of the U.S. role in World War II. Glenn, I know that you've read it and you're going to post your thoughts on those 10 things. You expanded it to 12 things, and we'll be posting that on our blog.
But I do have one question.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Ren.
I couldn't find a hand to lift up. But someone told me that their dad had B-17 flying into Hawaii as the Japanese were attacking. And all of their weapons were wrapped in oilcloth. And so they had no way of defending themselves, but they were able to land. I was wondering if they were flying to Europe, if their weapons were wrapped up or if they were armed and ready to go or not.
Well, they weren't wrapped. That's a good question on whether they were armed or not. I don't know the answer to that. Yeah, those B-17s flying into Pearl Harbor, they were the E model. And actually, I'll mention another thing. Joe Musial, one of my dad's waist gunners, he flew on a B-17 in the Pacific, had 70 missions in the Pacific, and he was at Pearl Harbor when it was bombed by Japan.
Whoa.
Wow. And then they let him go because they said, you know, you've flown enough, you've done your duty for your country, but he did felt it was his duty to go over to Europe and fight in Europe.
Oh, jeez.
That's those guys, they were the greatest generation. I mean, jeez.
Different breed of men, yes.
Totally. And by the way, Steve, Stan Musial's from Pittsburgh, Denora, close to Pittsburgh.
My dad's navigator, Robert Benninger, was from Pittsburgh.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Oh, yeah, my dad was the only crew member west of the Mississippi. Back then, all the population was in the east.
I was going to say, a reflection of where the people lived for the most part back then, right? Out of 130 million, I'd guess 90 million lived east of the Mississippi.
Yeah. And I was going to go to Trey, but before we get to the 10 things and to Trey, I was also just going to make the observation, your dad's height was probably a disadvantage also as he was hiding out in Europe. I mean, he must have been larger than most Europeans at that time, I'm guessing.
Yeah, well, absolutely. Absolutely. Well, he played, he was a good basketball player, and he played center on the on his bomb squadron team. You know, at 6'3", he was the center. Right. And that's why one reason my dad didn't have more missions that he tore the ligaments in his ankle playing basketball and couldn't fly for 2 months. So some of the other members on his crew had more missions than he did.
Trey, you were going to say something?
Yeah, I had two things I wanted to say. The first one, we were talking about B-17s in Pearl Harbor. I had two observations and also bombers getting attacked while they were flying into Pearl Harbor. I had two observations. One, this is a pretty famous story, but the original wave of Japanese bombers at Pearl Harbor were mistaken for B-17s, a flight of B-17s, because the radar operator was told by one of his flight, like the people on the flight control said, hey, if there's ever music playing at 3 a.m., that's to help the bombers get guided into the Pearl Harbor using the radio signal, because they didn't hire DJs to play music at 3 a.m. And when he turned on the radio, it was 3 a.m, there was music going. So he thought that the Japanese planes were actually B-17s. Very huge mistake. And also another thing I wanted to mention, if you've ever watched Midway, you'll know that Dauntlesses, SBD Dauntlesses from Yorktown and maybe Lexington. I don't know if Lexington, I think it was just, it was actually Enterprise, sorry. It was Enterprise. That they were jumped by Japanese fighters coming in as well. And the second thing, we were on the topic of Pittsburgh. My great-grandfather lived close, Cleveland. Ziggy Wojcik, if you're a friend of the Historical Society, you'll know that name. The old last name. And then my grandpa, Jim Wojcik, joined or moved to Pittsburgh and started the or helped found the Historical Society of Mount Lebanon.
Yes, and Jim is a good friend of mine and a great, great guy and knows a lot. When I found out that you were his grandson, it all made sense to me. So yes, absolutely. Matt Frankovich, you have a question that you put in the chat. Why don't you ask it?
Yeah, Steve, you had mentioned that your mom was at UCLA when Jackie Robinson was there. Did your mom know him personally?
You know, I'm not sure, but I think probably because they went through elementary school, high school, Pasadena Junior College, and UCLA.
Oh, so lifelong.
Yeah, they were the same. They were both born in 1919, so they were the same age.
I'll be darned. Cool.
I'll be darned is right.
That is neat.
Very cool.
When I was at UCLA, I was a classmate of Lew Alcindor, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar.
Yeah.
Yes. He was a little more than 6'3".
Yeah.
Now there's
those
a center.
Good, those were good years to watch UCLA basketball.
Did they lose? Did they lose it all while you were there and Wooden was coaching?
A couple times.
Yeah, maybe twice in 4 years. Jeez. Boy, this is great. Any other questions or comments? And I do want to say that I'm looking around. I see immediately we have two World War II vets with us now. Julia Parsons, a Navy Wave, and Bob Young. Hello, Bob. Good to see you. Another Navy guy. Wonderful. All right, Glenn, if you want to pitch one of the 10 things you need to know.
Sure. Sure, Steve, thanks very much. And please stay on. We're just, we have another sort of topic that we're going to bring up, something that I've been talking about with Todd for a couple of months. Todd, do you have the piece that we wrote? Can you put that up while I speak to it?
I could put that up. But you know, before I put that up, I'm going to put this up. And this is tomorrow morning. We have our program, our Veterans Breakfast Club program at 9 a.m. And we're going to be talking with Dick Thompson, right? Sean Hall, who was with the MACV-SOG, which is the Studies and Observation Group, which sounds like a innocuous name for some pretty serious warriors here, who these were the kind of people who dropped into, you know, way into the rear and did all kinds of demolition, sabotage, you know, sabotaging the Ho Chi Minh Trail, engaging the enemy way behind enemy lines. Dick Thompson was a member. He's going to join us tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. And we're going to talk about SOG and those guys. I know several of our veterans remember the MACV-SOG personnel in Vietnam. Sean, yeah, did you have anything else you wanted to add about that? Oh, can't hear you. Can't hear you, Sean.
Hello. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Yeah, I had a great time talking with Dick the other day. He's got some incredible stories to share. So I'm really excited to have him on the program tomorrow morning. And then come back Thursday night. We're having just a great week with VBC. Come back Thursday night for Generation 9/11, where we're going to talk about the withdrawal of Afghan troops, or withdrawal of troops from Afghanistan. And joining us also will be Wesley Morgan, the author of the recent book, The Hardest Place, about the Pesh Valley in Afghanistan. So, yeah, it's...
Yeah, and I got to tell you, Wesley Morgan, he went to Princeton University. Mm-hmm. As a junior, he had to write a senior thesis. He decided to write his senior thesis on the war in Afghanistan. And he got embedded with American troops in Afghanistan while he was a college student.
Mm-hmm.
how in the world that happened. I would love, I can't wait to hear that story.
Yeah. Yeah. He said it was something to do with Petraeus. There was something I heard in an interview that Petraeus made a decision that allotted him to be able to get embedded. So I'm interested to hear what that was.
And what did his parents have to say?
Exactly. I have that question written down.
Exactly. Okay. I'm going to share one of these. Let's see here. Oh, I think I could. Here it is. Glenn, this is your number one of your 12 things to know. Rick Atkinson only had 10, but our Glenn Flickinger has 12 things you need to know about the U.S. Army in World War II.
Well, let me just little preface here. Like a lot of you, and I've heard some of you express this, I am a huge fan of Rick Atkinson's. I've read, I think, every word that he's written. And I've listened to, I don't know for sure, but 95% of his podcasts, a lot of them through the Pritzker Military Society. I've even been able to, over the years, have a kind of a little bit of a dialogue with him via email, which I found very surprising that years ago, I sent him an email, via his website, and a week later, I got a response. And it's been back and forth, once a year, right? So this podcast is something he did at the Pritzker Military Society 12, 13 years ago. 10 things you should know about the U.S. Army in World War II. And if you had the chance to listen or watch it, you can watch it or listen to it. Todd had put the podcast in the newsletter a couple of days ago. I personally think it's a great foundation in the fundamentals of World War II from the veterans' point of view. Who were these men? Where did they come from? What training did they go through? What was the sort of macro situation that they found themselves in and why? So I had hoped that, and we're going to run out of time to do much of this tonight, but I'd hope that we could all watch that podcast, use this summary that I put together, which I think Todd is going to post at some point on the website or through an email, and then just have a discussion about the points that were made by Rick Atkinson. All right, number one, and I think most of us would know this, but he offers such pieces of details that I just find it fascinating. We all knew that in 1939, the U.S. Army was, as he put it, puny, right? Under 200,000 men, 14,000 officers. They were totally unprepared, ill-equipped, ill-trained, not ready for prime time, as it says, right? They were also very old. The average major, right? Just a middle sort of level rank as an officer was 48 years old. Aren't too many 48-year-olds that can fight in a war, right? A quarter of all lieutenants in the National Guard were over 40. And as he puts it in his podcast, the National Guard generals were certifiable political hacks, right? Because think about it, they were all from the local area. They were the mayor, the lieutenant governor, the judge who got into these positions because of their political connections and not their military, capabilities. So the fact that we then, and Steve's father is an excellent example of this, the fact that we then were able to turn that whole situation around so quickly, starting really only in 1940, when the draft occurred in the fall of 1940 and the nationalization of the National Guard and the reserves. Only then were we able to begin to turn the situation around and form the beginnings in 1940 and 41, an army that was worth the title Army or Army Air Force or Navy for that matter as well.
Here's another point that Atkinson makes, Glenn, that I'd love to talk to you about. And I think it has indirectly a lot to do with the story that we just heard, the Air Force story. The Army was supposed to be bigger. There were supposed to be more ground forces in World War II than what actually materialized. I mean, you point out, and Rick Atkinson points out, that the Liberty Plan, the war plan, the American war plan, when Pearl Harbor happened, was to have 215 Army divisions.
Correct.
Less than half of those, fewer than half of those materialized.
Right.
Now, they almost all went into combat. But why do you think that there was such deviation from the war plan?
Yeah, there's several reasons. Okay, the victory plan was put together by the very well-known general at that time on the U.S. Army planning staff, Albert Wiedemeyer. I'm never quite sure of how to pronounce that, right? Who's a fascinating man in himself, goes on to have a fascinating career during the war. And it was him and the planning staff who put that together. Another interesting aside about the Liberty Plan is it was released unofficially right the day or two before Pearl Harbor by the Chicago Tribune. And it was leaked to the press at that time with the idea of causing, we thought, the idea was to cause embarrassment to FDR.
The Tribune was the McCormick paper, and Robert McCormick was an enemy of FDR.
And one of the leading isolationist paper at the time, right?
Yeah.
And what's fascinating is subsequently, historians have pretty much proven that the person who leaked it was, hold for this, General Hap Arnold.
I was going to guess Hap Arnold. Oh my, that's the smoking gun. That's the smoking gun right there.
Now, he didn't physically do it, but a captain under his command in the Army Air Force released a copy of the study to Senator Wheeler, I think, or one of the isolationist senators. I can't remember that part for sure. And that's how it got into McCormick's hands, okay? So yeah, 215 divisions. I think that was 11 or 12 million men. It never materialized for several reasons, right? One, we just did not have the manpower to do that. Not the manpower to do that, and adequately staffed, adequately populated, I should say, the factories and the arm to produce 12,000 B-17s and 17,000 B-24s and millions of other components, right? So that was one element, right? The other was that the Army Air Force under Hap Arnold, this is one reason he released it, wanted to play a bigger role.
Yep.
And it was politics, if you will, within the military at that time as to how big was the ground forces were going to be versus how big the Army Air Forces. And we never had an Army Air Force to speak of until 1940. So it was only as the war developed that we could understand that we needed that large of an Air Force, which itself soaked up 2.5 million men or so.
If we were to cast back to 1943, 1944 even, I think we would all be a little surprised at how much we would very quickly learn that we were going to win the war through air power. That's it. The air power was going to win the war. And that is what most Americans believed. And, I think that was part of the joke that you shared, Steve, of the B-24 pilots joking about the B-17 pilots, having the publicist, on board. The Air Corps, the Army Air Corps, the Army Air Force got such just glowing publicity that it was the high technology that was going to win the war. And that helped to scale back the ground forces. After D-Day, that changes. But yeah, Steve.
Yeah, well, also, I think, after World War I and the tremendous losses in the trench warfare, where millions of men, fighting, on the ground, to avoid that, they wanted to have the air war with, the theory being that the Air Force would come in and do so much damage to the opponent that you wouldn't need as many ground troops.
Right.
And you could spare all the carnage that occurred during World War I.
Well, and it went so far, Steve, that Hap Arnold, Ira Aker, who you mentioned, and Carl Spatz, the very senior Army Air Force leadership, felt that they could win the war without the ground forces having to invade Europe, right? That was their strategic stance all through 1943 and 1944, right? Up until D-Day, obviously, right? Even in the 6 months leading up to D-Day, of course, there was the huge argument with Eisenhower and Hap Arnold as to who was going to control the 8th Air Force leading up to D-Day, which Eisenhower won that argument, right? So he could control what the targets were going to be in the months leading up to D-Day, right? So yeah, there was that belief proved wrong, unfortunately, that the Army Air Force could win the war without much of an invasion. Let's say only the Army would have to come in and mop up, okay? Yeah. What's ironic about that argument is it actually becomes true in the Pacific theater, right? We with the advent of the atomic bombs, yep, we ended up not having to invade Japan.
Yep.
And there's arguments that can be made that even without the atomic bombs, we could have just sat back and decimated all of Japan with, yep, conventional weapons.
Yep. But
that's a whole nother argument.
Wonderful point. And I find it so interesting that all sides, the one thing that all sides in World War II agreed on, the one thing that all sides agreed on, was that they did not want a replay of World War I, of static trench warfare, slugging it out on the ground. And every side was trying to find a way around that fate. Okay, Matt, I know you're taking off fatherly and husbandly duties. Call Larry Googans had to leave to put out the trash. Trey was having dinner. So maybe it is time. It's 8:32. We could call it quits. But Greg Yost, I do hope that you'll join us again, because you put in the chat a very intriguing comment about a story of the PA National Guard during World War II. The politicization of the U.S. Army was a real problem in the early days of the war, or pre-war, and especially so in the National Guard, especially so in the much of our military was National Guard. Greg, I hope you'll join us again and maybe share that story, because I'd love to hear it. Okay, very good. Steve Snyder, thank you so much for joining us from Seal Beach, California. What a pleasure. You'd be welcome to join us anytime you'd like for any of our programs. Share more of your story, whatever you want to do. Have an announcement. It was great having you. Glenn, thank you for hosting.
Thank you. My pleasure, as always. And let's just one last plug for our next show, our next program in May.
Oh, yeah.
I'll let you tell them who we've got coming on in May.
We have one of the few remaining Tuskegee Airmen, Colonel Harry Stewart, will be joining us on May 26th.
I think that's it. The fourth Tuesday of May.
Fourth Tuesday of May? Is that May 26th or 25th?
I'm not sure.
I can't remember. I think it's 26th. Yes, he's going to be joining us from Michigan.
25th.
Thank you, Jim Jameson. May 25th, Colonel Harry Stewart, one of the few, he was a pilot, P-51 pilot. Served with the 15th Air Force, I think 7 kills, and a fascinating person. And we got him, and we're going to hear his story 1 month from today, Tuesday, May 25th. Fantastic. All right. But before then, I hope you see you tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. or Thursday night at 7 p.m. All right. Take care, everyone. Thanks for joining us. Good night.
Thank you.